Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author, who assesses Donald Trump's decision to join Israel's attack on Iran that ignored key U.S. intelligence assessments, which didn't support the rationale for war. Vietnam veteran Mike Ferner, who talks about the veterans and allies' 40-day fast for Gaza that participants hope will draw attention to the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza and end the suffering of Palestinian civilians there. And Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, who maintains that the Democratic Party must adopt a bold progressive economic policy agenda to have any chance to defeat the Trump Republican authoritarian power grab. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On June 3rd, an El Salvadoran jury convicted four former high-ranking military officers, including an ex-defense minister, for the murder of four Dutch TV journalists in the 1980s. The Icon TV journalists were killed in Chalatenango province by Salvadoran soldiers during a planned ambush behind rebel lines on March 17, 1982. This was one of many atrocities targeting foreign nationals during El Salvador's civil war that created an uproar in the Netherlands. A United Nations Truth Commission report in 1993 concluded the ambush was deliberately planned to surprise and kill the journalists who were making a documentary about the nation's civil war. The convicted former army officers, now in their 90s, were not in court during the trial, which sentenced the three men to 15 years in prison. In convicting the three former army officers, the jury condemned El Salvador's government for delaying the case for decades. Pressure to act on the murdered journalists came from the Dutch government, the victims' families, and Salvadoran civil society groups. El Salvador's civil war was fought from 1980 to 1992, pitting leftist guerrillas against the U.S.-backed Salvadoran army that left 75,000 people dead and 8,000 more missing. In recent testimony before Congress, Donald Trump's Veterans Affairs Secretary, Doug Collins, was questioned about his role in degrading services for millions of U.S. military veterans who depend on VA hospitals across the nation for basic health care and treatment of physical and psychological war wounds. Democrats on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs expressed anger at Collins' decision to fire 1,000 probationary employees, cancel hundreds of contracts with vendors that supply the VA with critical resources, and terminate VA researchers interrupting clinical trials to benefit veterans. And then Collins vowed to lay off an additional 83,000 VA employees. The American Prospect reported that after the Senate hearing, a group of 60 members of Common Defense, a progressive veterans organization that has launched a nationwide campaign called VA Not For Sale, joined nurses and Congress members on the steps of the U.S. Capitol to protest Collins' plans for arbitrary mass layoffs and budget cuts. Tenants in Kansas City declared victory after concluding an 8-month rent strike, the longest tenant action in the Midwestern city's history. The tenants' union at Independence Towers negotiated an agreement with the building's new owners to win commitments to complete years of delayed repairs. The campaign employing tactics used by labor unions is now seen as a model for other tenant organizations in affordable housing projects across the nation. The Independence Towers Tenant Union signed a 1-year agreement with the building's new owner, Dynasty Properties, which holds rent steady this year and offers lease renewals that keep increases under 5%, a grace period for late rent payments, and formally recognizes the tenants' union as a bargaining partner which will renegotiate the terms next year. Tenants will not be required to pay back rent from their 8-month strike, and all current tenants' leases will be renewed. In these Times reports that the win at Independence Towers gives national tenant organizers hope that what tenants accomplished in Kansas City could serve as a model nationwide. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After Donald Trump entered Israel's war against Iran by ordering the U.S. military to bomb 3 of Iran's most heavily fortified nuclear sites, and Iran responded by launching missiles at a U.S. military base in Qatar, resulting in no casualties, the U.S. president announced on June 23rd that a shaky ceasefire had been reached that could end the 12-day war. Israeli missile strikes and Iranian counterattacks in the conflict killed more than 600 Iranians and 28 Israelis, with hundreds more injured on both sides. Israel's intense bombing campaign against Iran, launched on June 13th, targeted the Islamic Republic's nuclear sites, military infrastructure, assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists, and key figures in Iran's military and intelligence leadership. While Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that Iran was just weeks away from building a nuclear weapon, that assertion was contradicted by President Trump's own Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who testified before Congress in March that Iran was not developing a nuclear weapons program. Reports indicate that Iran likely removed enriched uranium and other equipment from the targeted sites before they were bombed by U.S. B-2 bombers. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, Director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project, who talks about President Trump's order to launch U.S. airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities without the authorization of Congress. A decision, like President George W. Bush's launch of America's disastrous 2003 invasion of Iraq, appeared to ignore or manipulate intelligence that didn't support the rationale for war.
The people around Trump have been very divided on this question of regime change wars, foreign wars, international wars, forever wars. They have different names, but for basically opposition to the kinds of wars that the United States has been fighting for the last 25 years. And those who have supported these wars, people like the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and others who have long supported this, have seemingly forgotten what this kind of a war led to. 20 years of war in Iraq, thousands of U.S. soldiers dead, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians killed in that war. What happened in Afghanistan? Again, thousands of U.S. soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Afghans who were killed, leaving the country in a disastrous situation. Not terribly much better in Iraq, a little bit, but not much. So they've forgotten that part, but what they haven't forgotten, as you say, was the language of how they justified it back in those days. We're hearing the same things we heard from Colin Powell about, we break it, we own it, we have to be responsible for it, so regime change is going to have to be on the agenda. You know, it's an extraordinary thing that these memories not only seem to have disappeared from all these people, but they have the expectation that none of the rest of us remember it either, that somehow this is all new and fresh, the idea that this is a terrible government, and the people will welcome us with rice and flowers. Remember that one? That was a Rumsfeld line. They will welcome us with rice and flowers. How many times now have we heard that the people of Iran hate their government and they will rise up and support any U.S. bombing campaign? Well, it turns out that people are not so keen about another country coming and bombing their own country, killing their neighbors, destroying their homes, and then believing somehow that that's what leads to a happy population that is delighted to have a new U.S.-chosen leader. So right now, at this moment, it seems that the idea of going further militarily and trying to carry out a military decapitation, if you will, of the leadership in Iran is not on the agenda. That could change within the hour. We're seeing these kinds of flip-flops at breathtaking speed. with no idea where it comes from. When President Trump says, as he has now said three or four times, when people have questioned him about Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, the NDI, the top-ranking intelligence officer of the entire so-called intelligence community, who has testified in Congress and who has essentially cut her political teeth in opposing these kinds of wars and in specifically saying that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, his answer was, I think she's wrong. On another occasion, he said, I don't believe her. And somehow nobody in the press challenges him and says, well, excuse me, Mr. President, but she is in charge of our intelligence community. Where are you getting your information? Where does your counterintuitive information come from? If you have better intelligence than our intelligence community, shouldn't you be sharing it with them? Shouldn't you be sharing it with us? Where are you getting that information? None of that exists. It's something that the president seems to just make up whole cloth. No one around him has indicated that they have any familiarity with any other countering intelligence. He just decided he doesn't like it, so he's not going to abide by it. He's not going to build his policies on the actual intelligence. He's going to do something else. What it is, we don't know. He's now bragging about a ceasefire. We'll see. We'll see whether there is a real ceasefire or not. So we just don't know where any of this leads at this point.
Well, fellas, just a last thought from you on really the root cause of why we're in this situation today, why the world faces this crisis. It's clear to many in this country and the world that this entire conflict is the responsibility of one man, Donald Trump, who unilaterally tore up the JCPOA nuclear agreement in 2018 that was negotiated by the Obama administration with partners of European nations, Russia, and China in 2015. We would not be here today if that agreement was not unilaterally abrogated by one Donald Trump.
It's absolutely right. And that's why the work right now in Congress to prevent Donald Trump from going further down this path is so, so crucial. It may be as early as Wednesday that some of the vote may begin to happen. Some of it may be later in the week, but it's urgent right now that people be taking seriously the need to pressure members of Congress to support the various war powers resolutions that are pending in both the Senate and the House. This is what stands between the possibility of this war being escalated, continuing, and potentially leading to the kind of decades-long war that we saw in the earlier part of this century and that I think no one with a brain in this country has any interest in repeating. So it's become an urgent reality just right now.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project and author. Find a link to her recent article, "And the U.S. War in Iran Now," and related analysis and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Six members of Veterans for Peace have since May 22nd engaged in a 40-day fast in solidarity with the people of Gaza, consuming just 250 calories a day. That's considered a starvation diet. That's the amount of calories, a recent report said, is the average consumed by Palestinians in Gaza, under assault and blockade by Israel, supported by the Trump regime. Since their fast began, the veterans have maintained a vigil outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations in New York City. At least 800 others in the U.S. and around the world are also fasting in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Some fasters are limiting themselves to the 250-calorie daily diet, while others are fasting from dawn to dusk or shorter periods. As starvation and violence worsens in Gaza, the veterans and allies fast activists are demanding full humanitarian aid be restored to Gaza under UN authority and no more U.S. weapons be sent to Israel. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mike Ferner, a former National Director of Veterans for Peace who served in the Navy during the Vietnam War and later discharged as a conscientious objector. Ferner began the fast with the others, but was forced to drop out after 21 days due to health reasons. Here he talks about his hope that the fast will draw attention to the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza and end the suffering of Palestinian civilians there.
We picked 250 calories for the main people who are going to be fasting. We picked that number because as of several months ago, that was considered to be the average caloric intake for people in Gaza. And Lord knows by now, it's probably nowhere near 250 calories, which is, we've found out on the fast, it is a starvation diet. And in addition to that, you know, we go home every night, those of us in New York, and other people around the country that are doing this have a safe place to sleep. We don't have to have the constant anxiety and fear of being bombed at any minute. We have clean water to drink and all those sorts of things. So the fast is a tiny fraction of what the people in Gaza are going through. But we hoped by doing it to call people's attention to what's happening in Gaza. And it's, you know, I got to say, it's personally, for everybody I've talked to who's involved with it, it's been personally transforming. So it's been an amazing experience. And like 800 or more people in the U.S., and there are handfuls of people in South Africa, Ireland, France, Italy, Germany, Canada, and Australia who are participating with us.
You said it's been personally transformative. Can you say a little more about that? How?
Well, when you're on a starvation diet, you know, extremely limited calories or nothing at all, you start to notice some changes within a few days. Everything slows down. You know, you don't move as fast. You can't think as fast. You know, I do some writing. I've done the news releases for the group. You know, something that would take me a couple hours to knock out, I'm working on it a day and a half. You know, I mean, your brain just isn't functioning. You know, what's that? What would that add to the burden that people in Gaza are experiencing? You know, I have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walk miles to try to find water or food. And you're already half knackered because of the limited amount of food that you've got. You know, so you stand in line. I mean, you just get fatigued, you get tired, your resistance is down, everything just goes to pot. And if you're in those conditions for, you know, we found within a week, it really begins to affect your ability to function. And if you've been like that for months, you know, God knows how they're even surviving. And I came close to dying from an electrolyte imbalance that I was unaware of. And it just made me realize, you know, if I'd have been in Gaza, that'd have been it.
What kind of response did you get? Is it a very busy area where a lot of people going by? Was there a lot of interest, or did they ignore you?
It was interesting. The pedestrians consisted, as far as I could tell, mostly of tourists and people who were probably working in the UN or working at some of the various restaurants or offices that surround the UN. Most of the people just look straight ahead and try to avoid seeing protesters there. After we were there for a while, increasingly, pedestrians would stop and thank us for what we were doing. Some of them working for the UN and said, you know, I can't come out and say this publicly, but it's very important what you're doing. And I'm so glad because this gives people an opportunity to do something more. And we went to Grand Central Station and we did a die-in there. And we've been at various things around the city. And overwhelmingly, people have been supported, overwhelmingly. Our hope is obviously to draw attention to what's going on in Gaza, but also to motivate a greater number of people to be involved by participating in a fast at some level. And then from there, staying active with the good people that they've met and upping the ante of their activism. So we can just keep trying to do more than we've done before. And that's what I hope comes out of this.
That was Mike Ferner, former National Director of Veterans for Peace, and an early participant in the Veterans and Allies 40-day fast for Gaza. Learn more about the famine that threatens Gaza's 2.3 million residents and the Veterans Fast by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nationwide June 14th No Kings Day protests, with more than 5 million participants in 2,100 locations, was the largest demonstration of opposition yet to the twice-impeached president's authoritarian agenda since he returned to the White House in January. But the growing anti-Trump protest movement on its own can't stop the president's and Republican Party's unpopular militarized mass deportations, reckless imposition of tariffs, and the slashing of the nation's social safety net programs to give massive tax cuts to the rich. Many Americans who oppose Trump's policies, including those who voted for him last November, have little confidence in the Democratic Party leadership's ability to mount effective opposition to a president who, in recent multiple public opinion polls, has hit a record low approval rating in his second term. In a recent commentary, Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, asserts that the Democratic Party will need a very different orientation to regain support from the millions of working-class voters whose non-voting or defection to Trump last fall put him back in the White House. Your reporter spoke with Solomon, who, while encouraged by the momentum and activism of millions of Trump opponents, maintains that the Democrats must end their addiction to corporate campaign funding and adopt a bold progressive economic policy agenda in order to have a chance to defeat the Trump GOP authoritarian power grab.
We really need to see No King's Day as a start, as simply a springboard to what needs to happen, which is intensive grassroots organizing. Virtually every neighborhood should be a place where people are canvassed, where there are events, where there is an upsurge of activism and activity, and organizing both electorally and outside the electoral system to build the kind of opposition to this truly fascistic regime called the Trump administration, what's really imperative. Some people listening may feel, understandably, well, I'm listening to a discussion about how the Democratic Party should step up and so forth, but really, shouldn't we all just be talking about how bad Trump is? Well, Trump is atrocious. He's the worst president in any of our lifetimes, the most dangerous president in any of our lifetimes. But the fact is that No King's Day was organized without the Democratic Party. If we'd left it to the leading Democrats in the House and the Senate and the Democratic National Committee, nothing like that would have happened this year at all, nothing close to it. So that's a tip-off that we can't depend on any Democratic Party institution to do what needs to be done. We've got to do that ourselves. And the contradiction, the simultaneous truth is that when the election rolls around next year, the midterms, the only electoral instrument to take the House away from these dangerous people like Mike Johnson, who are running the House of Representatives, the only electoral vehicle to gin up, to gun up, to ride, to defeat the Republicans next year in the congressional elections will be the Democratic Party. So we're in a position of needing to challenge the party to expose its often craven complicity, in some cases with the Trump agenda, serving Wall Street in a way that doesn't help mobilize voters for the Democrats. That's all true. We have to challenge that. We need to acknowledge it. At the same time, we're going to need the Democratic Party candidates to defeat Republicans in 2026.
Norman, what are the key ingredients, in your view, to make the Democratic Party more responsive to voters, to respond to the crises, the economic crises that many families across the country are experiencing and have been experiencing for many, many years under Republican and Democratic presidents? There is a sea change that you say is essential. What are the issues that need to be articulated by Democratic candidates and the party itself to make people excited about policies that could improve their lives and make ends meet? I mean, people can't pay for health care. There's trouble paying for college. There's so many areas of life in America where people are falling behind the experience of their own parents.
For the first time in memory, the working class vote went more to Republicans last fall. And that tells us that, as Bernie Sanders said, it shouldn't surprise us when the working class abandons the Democratic Party after the Democratic Party abandoned the working class. So the only way to defeat the phony, faux, pseudo-populism of the Republican Party is not with the neoliberal models of, you know, watered-down liberal formulas and corporate power with a few populist bits of rhetoric. That's not going to do it. It hasn't worked. What will do it potentially is to have genuine progressive populism that doesn't kick down, that doesn't blame immigrants. It kicks up at the people who are exploiting the workers and who are making gazillions of dollars of excess profits while people, as you know, are struggling to pay their rent and send their kids to college and all the rest of it, with the health care system here just in such a disastrous shape for so many people. So I think part of the necessity is for us to organize, push, and demand that the Democratic Party have a truly progressive populist agenda. That means that we need absolutely drastically progressive taxation. We need to tax the wealthy and corporations at a very high rate, cut the military budget substantially. I don't call it a defense budget. Very little of it has to do with genuine defense. And we need to have a real regulatory structure to break up these huge corporations, to have a genuine antitrust department in the Justice Department, to have a real Justice Department that fights for people instead of corporations. This kind of progressive populism is a real possibility if we can organize effectively and demand it effectively of the Democratic Party. That's the programmatic part. Procedurally, we need to stop being so respectful of Democrats in Congress. There is a tendency when progressives see someone who has a D after their name in the House or the Senate, and they do some things we like, then we defer to them. We are almost obsequious sometimes. We thank them excessively when they're doing some terrible things, when they don't really fight the Trump agenda, where they support wars, where they vote for these huge military budgets. So it's about a progressive populist program, and it's about activism from the grassroots, because that's how social change happens.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and author. Find a link to his recent commentary titled, "No King's Day Was Historic, Now We Need a Powerful and Independent Movement Against Trump," by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KGHI in Westport, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.